There's so much good evidence in animals and humans that making activities fun gets you better engagement and better learning.
Welcome to the Believe in Dog podcast. I'm your host, Erin Scott, and I've been a dog mom for over 20 years. On this podcast, we are going to celebrate the amazing parts of being a pet parent. We're going to navigate the challenges together and learn everything that dog moms and dog dads should know. I believe that dogs can show up in our lives as healers, as teachers, and as inspirations, and I can't wait to get started. This is Believe in Dog. Welcome to episode 91 of the Believe in Dog podcast. I'm your host, Erin Scott, and thank you so much for being here today. So we actually have a previous guest to thank for putting today's guest, Kelly Lee, on my radar. So thank you to Anne King from episode 87. Anne had mentioned something called a petting consent test, and she sent me the link for it, and it was on Kelly Lee's YouTube page for her business, Dog Kind Training. And I thought that this was really brilliant, especially when you're dealing with a new dog in your home, or if you're somebody who's in like the shelter or rescue world. And so I had reached out to Kelly to talk about the petting consent test. And then when I was checking out the information for her business, Dog Kind Training, I realized that she was just a wealth of information, particularly about building confidence in dogs and working with fearful dogs. Whether you have a dog that suffers with generalized fear, like my guy Nino, or whether you have a dog that has a more specific fear or situational fear, if it's something like nail trims or going to the vet that stress your dog out, I think you'll really get a lot out of what Kelly has to share today. And we are going to dive more into this after a quick word from one of our sponsors. Even though February was Pet Dental Health Month, we really need to care about our dog's dental health all year long. I recently learned that 80% of our dogs over 3 years old have active dental or periodontal disease. And dental disease is actually a sign of other inflammation in the body and can be connected to everything from cardiovascular problems, kidney problems, diabetes, certain types of cancers, joint disease. Your dog's dental health actually can affect everything in their body. And you know that I am obsessed with finding the best and healthiest products for our dogs. So I was so excited to find out about Teef. That's right, Teef. Just a tiny spoonful of Teef powder in your dog's water bowl will make a huge improvement in your dog's dental health. It's the only thing that ever made my vet stop and go, "Hey, what did you do with Penny's teeth? They actually look so much better." So forget trying to figure out how to get your dog's teeth brushed without them biting you. Forget those sticks or green chews. What you need is Teef powder, just a tiny amount in your dog's water bowl. And listeners of this podcast can save 20% on your Teef order with the code ADM. And you'll be on your way to a healthier smile for your dog without any anesthesia needed. Check out the link in the show notes to find out more about Teef and save 20% on your orders. This code will work on their cat product too. One of the first things that stood out to me about Kelly was that it was her own experiences with a fearful dog that her husband adopted while she was out of the country that inspired her to learn more about dog training and then eventually make it her second or actually maybe her third career. And all the experiences that Kelly's had with her own dogs has helped inspire her to really concentrate her business efforts on working with fearful dogs. Kelly will share with us her do's and don'ts for increasing your dog's confidence in any kind of situation, as well as some common mistakes that people make, particularly when introducing a new fearful dog to their home. I think one of the biggest takeaways that I got from my conversation with Kelly is about taking it slow and really breaking it down. And she'll give us some different examples of how we can do this. Because to us, it might seem like, oh, we're just going to go trim their nails. But Kelly really shows us how to like break this down with like granularity for when we're introducing something new, or even if we're trying to reintroduce something that maybe they've had a fearful response to in the past. And of course, we're going to talk about the petting consent video too. I'll have a link for you in the show notes so you can check it out. And if you stick around till the end of the episode, I'll tell you about what happens when I try it with my dogs. So let's get started. I can't wait for you to meet Kelly Lee. So I am here today with dog trainer extraordinaire Kelly Lee. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. I'm excited to talk to you. I have a ton of things I want to ask you about. But I always love starting off asking about your childhood experiences with pets. I didn't even know that I liked dogs at all until I was 25.
Oh, wow.
I always joke that I was a reluctant dog owner. It was all my husband's idea to get a dog, and it has changed my whole life. And so I'm always curious what that looks like for other people. Are you someone who grew up with pets in your life?
Yes, I was the kid who nagged the parents from a young age for pets. And they did, they caved. Early on, they tried to make me happy with fish. I had guppies and then gerbils. And eventually, I think I was probably 10 or 11, and I was the oldest. They got a Bichon puppy for us. And that was my childhood dog. Little sassy little thing, really sweet. So, yeah, I mean, I had a lot of the smaller pets when I had them, but we only had the one dog growing up.
Every Bichon I've ever met has been very sassy.
Yeah. She was great. Her name was Pogo. She lived till like 17 or something.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Is that what made you want a career with animals?
No, I always loved animals, but I bounced around a lot when deciding on careers. And really, dog training was a second career, or perhaps third career for me. I did work with animals before that, but more wildlife work. I decided to get into dog behavior specifically when my now husband came home with a puppy. Actually, he brought the puppy home. I was out of the country for work, and he surprised me with a puppy he found in the newspaper. And I thought she was the best thing ever, but she did end up having a lot of fear-related issues. And so I was very interested in how to help her. And that was sort of the beginning. I didn't get into professional training for several years, but that's where my interest started for sure.
So I saw that you went to the Academy for Dog Trainers. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the Jean Donaldson School?
Yeah.
Yeah, I've looked into that. That's like, what do they call it? Like the Harvard of dog training schools?
Yeah. Yeah, it's about a 2-year program, depending on how fast you do it. And if you have dogs, you can work with your own dogs for the submissions, the videos and things, which is kind of fun. I did that after I had already been working, doing some professional training by the time I went to the academy. I had apprenticed for several years with a local trainer, actually Juno's puppy trainer, my girl's puppy trainer, and then had started teaching some classes for that trainer and had started working at an animal shelter. That was the beginning of my big sort of shift in career at the time I started. So I had some dog training experience under my belt, but definitely the academy helped me a lot.
So is it because of your experiences with Juno that got you interested in this, like working with the fearful dogs specifically?
She definitely started it. And then working in the animal shelter, many dogs are, even if they maybe wouldn't be that fearful sort of out in the normal world, we're pretty scared. Yeah. And so we're dealing with fear a lot there. So I've been interested in fearful dogs for a long time. I didn't really specialize, like really specifically specialize until the last couple of years, partly because my business model changed to one where I could specialize more easily. And partly because of my experiences with my third of my three dogs, the more recent addition, Pancake, who's a little guy who came to us with some pretty severe fear.
So I've had some different experiences with fear. We have like our guy, Nino, who when he came to us was like a very shut down dog. And, you know, was the type, like, if he heard, like, the dishwasher come on, like, he would flatten out on the ground, like, hit the deck. What was that? You know, and so, like, to us, right, it's been, like, huge wins over the, you know, years that we've had him, like, that he's very comfortable in our home. And, you know, that he, like, this is his, like, safe space. Like, but he still gets uncomfortable if he has to go somewhere else or meet anybody else or if anybody comes over our house.
Right.
You know, so he kind of has like is like very fearful of the world. And then I have like, for instance, our girl Nessie here, who on the surface seems like this very confident dog, but then like is very fearful of having her nails trimmed.
Oh, sure.
I accidentally made her afraid of towels because she was covered in mud. And to me, it seemed like a normal thing to wipe with a towel, not thinking that maybe she had never experienced this before, you know? And so we had to rethink our process with cleaning mud. And so what do you see most often in your work? Is it kind of more of the generalized fear or like fear of like very specific like situations or circumstances?
You know, it's all probably the more specific fears that are more common generally, but sort of my sort of population that I work with now mostly tend to be dogs with sort of global fear. So they're afraid of sounds, they're afraid of the outside world, they're maybe afraid of their people, their family, definitely afraid of being touched, sometimes afraid of other animals. But I mean, those are fairly extreme cases. And I'm not sure if they're extreme because they're uncommon or just because most people, if those dogs are adopted, most people aren't prepared to cope with that. So I don't end up seeing them because they end up being returned to the rescue or whatever.
You know, I always think about when we went to meet Nino, and it was through a shelter event, and we had brought our old gal Penny, who has now passed on, and we had just had her at the time, and they had this meet and greet set up, and it was like, oh, we didn't even care. Like, this is great. And kind of like looking at it now through the lens that I have, I realize he was a completely, like, we call it zombie dog mood when he is just so completely shut down, you know, to the world that he's just not even acknowledging anyone or anything. And like, that's what was going on. Not like, oh, it's great. But they did end up getting along wonderfully. But
thank goodness. Yeah.
So when you have a dog that has like those global fears like this, how can we as like the pet parents, like how can we help them start to feel safe and create a safe, like let them know that this is a safe space?
Well, we actually have, if you remind me later, we have a couple free PDFs on this specifically on setting up safe spaces and sort of how to make things go the right direction with a fearful dog. But one of the most common mistakes that people make when they bring home a very fearful dog is trying to treat it like a quote unquote normal dog. So, you know, trying to pet the dog, take the dog for walks, maybe, you know, try to show the dog that the house is safe by, you know, forcibly pulling them out from a hiding spot. And unfortunately, most of the time that stuff backfires and just ends up teaching the dog that you are not safe for them. Even though to us, those things seem really innocuous. You're like, you're just, you know, taking him for a walk. Dogs like walks. Well, this dog doesn't like walks or, you know, doesn't know yet that walks could be good. So the first thing is to allow them to hide, try to provide comfort usually in the form, not of you, because new people for a lot of fearful dogs aren't a source of comfort. They're just scary. So, you know, good bedding, make sure they have all their food, water, and toys, sort of a low traffic area, multiple hiding options. I like a crate they could go into, but then also like maybe a kind of fencing of some kind that you cover with a blanket. So the crate isn't their only option to get out of sight from people. you know, try to set up their daily life so that they don't have to be forced to do anything they find scary. And unfortunately for a lot of dogs, fortunately for a lot of people with these dogs, that includes going outside to eliminate. So for a lot of these dogs, unless it's clear that they are happy to go out and you have a fenced yard or something, a lot of times potty pads or something are going to be the lowest stress option, at least initially.
I'm feeling really fortunate right now that Nino loved going outside and loved that part of it. Like, it always seemed to us that outside was almost like it felt safer to him than being inside.
Yeah, that I found that happens with dogs that had been living outside, but not always, strangely. But yeah, usually for most of the dogs that I work with who are very fearful, it's like one or the other. Like, inside is safe and outside is like, no way, is too scary. Or the backyard is fine and they're always anxious in the house. I think it's, and we don't, we'll, a lot of times we'll never know why. You know, we don't really know their history, but
right.
Yeah, it's a lot.
Yeah, I feel, you know, one of our previous dogs before that had been slightly anxious on like the anxious maybe end of the spectrum, but not like not around people. It was more like thunderstorms, you know, maybe going to like the vet had always made her like a little nervous. She would actually get nosebleeds every time. Like, she would get so stressed out, she would get nosebleeds if she went.
Oh.
And so we were always glad that we had had that dog's name was Kahlua, that like she kind of had set us up for kind of understanding Nino a little bit. Like, we were always glad like Nino wasn't like our first dog or something, you know, and that we kind of, you know, even though sometimes I'm like, well, he doesn't like to leave the house and he doesn't like anybody to come over the house, to us, it still feels amazing, like how happy and comfortable he is here. And, yeah, you know, he likes to walk and hike and do things, and we can do all of those things without him having to get in the car from our house, you know. And that feels like amazing, that like 99% of his life is good, except he just goes to the vet every once in a while, you know.
Yeah, I think that's great. I mean, a lot of time, I think it is hard that a lot of times when people do end up with fearful dogs as their first dog as an adult, or even if it's not, but they've only had pretty, you know, quote unquote, easy dogs before that, they had a vision of what this dog would be like and the things that they would be able to do with this dog. And some of those things might never be in reach.
Yeah.
You know, but it doesn't mean that dog can't have a good quality of life. Even if it's, you know, at home, they're happy and they can enjoy walks in quiet areas. They don't need to, you know, go to the farmer's market or whatever, go watch parades and go to other busy locations, go to the dog park. But it's for a lot of us, it can be kind of a big adjustment in terms of our expectations.
Yeah, I was just thinking of like adjusting the expectations, like, he is not the dog that's going to be in the car with his head out the window having a great day, you know. But my other girl was, and you know. And so when you're working with dogs like this, what are some ways that we can start, you know, increasing their confidence? Because if I were to look back, I couldn't tell you what we did other than just trying to take it slow and make everything feel fun, you know, and like give rewards for like the littlest thing. But that's really all I could tell you.
Well, honestly, that's probably more than half of the work is, number one, taking it slow, and that's slow according to the dog, not according to us.
Right.
And that usually means, that's a big part of, not forcing things is a big part of that. You know, don't physically pull your dog on the leash. Don't pull them out from hiding places. Don't, you know, try to push them or carry them, you know, outside if they're afraid to go outside. And then, so they get to choose what they do. And then making their environment really rich in good things. Food, toys. Most dogs really like food. Any individual dog, you never know what kind of toys or activities they might like. So you might have to experiment. So at first you just make the environment just like awesome for them. So anything they do, you know, peeking their head out of a crate, oh, hello, is that some chicken, you know? So these teeny little behaviors that we need, you have to start somewhere. If they never peek their head out of the crate, they're never going to take one step out of the crate. That means they're never going to end up exploring the room and then the rest of the house. So making all those behaviors pay off and sort of develop a pattern or predictability for them of this environment, there's good stuff in this environment, and there are a lot of things I can do to get that good stuff. You know, I have some control over that. Now, once you have them sort of more comfortable, at least moving around the house, then you can start to do more structured, you know, training, usually with food, but some dogs like toys better, so that's okay. You can use toys. Then you can sort of work on more deliberately training certain skills that will be helpful to sort of make their world bigger. A lot of that starts with just being able to be in the same room with you and interacting with you, even if it's at a distance. A lot of these dogs, one of the first challenges is, will they eat anything, even really good stuff, if you're in the same room with them? So once they can eat when you're in the same room, then, you know, can you kind of direct a little attention to them, even if it's out of the corner of your eye? So you can start to do little training games. Like really simple, like take one step out of your crate or turn your head toward me. That's all it takes to get a treat. So little baby skills. And then from that, you can start to build on, you know, proximity. Because you can't do the kind of normal training sessions you would do with a dog who's less fearful, where you know, sit next to them and you like sit down, shake, treat, treat, treat. A lot of these dogs can't tolerate even being that close to their person, and definitely not for like many minutes at a time. It's just like way too much. So you have to work up to that before you can, you know, do that kind of training that most people are used to starting with, like with puppies or a more regular sort of less fearful dog. So there's a lot, but what it comes down to big picture is don't force them, make good stuff happen all the time easily. Don't put pressure on them to like, you have to do this if you want this good thing. Just try to make it readily available. And when you start training, it should be super low pressure. The dog should be winning, like getting it right, like every time. So it's so easy that they're just always getting it right. And then you can slowly move on from there.
One of the things I liked about your company is it's called Dog Kind. And I just loved that. I felt like there was a couple, like you could do a couple different meanings with that. I liked that, you know, like there's human kind, dog kind, there's being kind to dogs, you know, it was great. But you went on like, talked about the training philosophy. And one of the things I really liked that you mentioned was that it's not just about treats, right? That it's playing games, it's giving attention. It's, you know, toys, like you mentioned, because each dog kind of has like a different preference. And so I think a lot of times I hear people talk about like, oh, you're bribing the dog with treats or something to get them to do what you want. But I also like that you can make it fun, that you can make it like more of a play. And that's, you know, with this one that's chewing her bone very loudly next to me right now, you know, like she has reminded me of just like how much fun and much play dogs want to have. And so that's been like a great reminder to me. And so I loved that you included that kind of like as part of your philosophy.
Yeah. And something that can be helpful to thinking about making training fun. There are lots of reasons to do that. And it's not just a kind of feel good thing. Like, well, I, you know, in my heart, I feel that we should be nice to dogs and training should be fun. I mean, I do feel that way. But there's so much good evidence in animals and humans that making activities fun gets you better engagement and better learning. That's why if you look at like apps for people to do anything from like, I have a biking app, for instance, for our stationary bike. And one of the reasons it's so popular is that it makes what would normally not be that fun of an activity more fun. It's sort of, so this idea of like gamification in stuff for people online, especially, is really popular. And that's because people will buy your thing and stick with it longer if it is fun for them to do. And so, and what that really means is that there's reinforcement built into the activity. right, in the app or whatever. And so same thing with dogs. We could train, like I could try to teach a dog to go out by pulling on their leash in a way that it was uncomfortable until they stepped forward. And then the, and technically I would be reinforcing stepping forward in theory by releasing that leash pressure, but that's not very fun for the dog. And I may end up with the dog then avoiding the leash in the future or like not wanting to work with me basically because it's not fun. So yeah, it is, it's more enjoyable for the dog if it's fun. In my experience, most people enjoy it more too.
Working, yeah, I was thinking that too.
And that's one of the big challenges too with dog training, with anything that like we have to do that's like a task of some kind, that if it's not enjoyable for us, we're going to tend to procrastinate, you know, or like kind of do it just a little, but not as much as maybe we should. So there are lots of reasons to make training fun, and it's somewhat for the dog and somewhat for us.
I do not at all feel attacked by that statement.
I mean, I put off training all the time, even though it is mostly fun, just because it still takes effort and you have a lot of other things competing for your time. But
I always feel like dog training needs like a rebranding, or like we need a better word, because training in itself like has this kind of like negative connotation. Or I think of like, you know, somebody like at a dog show that's like running around a ring, or you know, like that's kind of like the mental image I get. And yet, you know, I like, you know, being silly with her. I like, you know, getting her, like, even though she's only been with us a short time, like she will go in a stay and I can leave the room and, you know, deal with my other dog and she doesn't move a muscle, and then we celebrate when, you know, and it's just been so much fun to see, you know, that. And I mean, this one's definitely going to need, she's a little more intense than some of our past dogs. So I'm like, we need to get out there and get in the classes and get in the sports and do the things that I'm not super familiar with and get out of my comfort zone. You know, I am looking forward to it because she's so much fun, you know.
And you know she'll love it. So, yes. And then that'll make you happy to see. Yeah,
exactly. Like I love that reinforcement cycle, you know. So one thing I feel like I personally have been very fortunate that I haven't had to deal with myself is like fear aggression. And so is that something that you see a lot in the work that you do?
Yes. I would say it frequently pops up. I don't specialize in aggression per se. Like a lot of the dogs I work with are just really shut down and are hiding a lot. But as you know, a dog who, certainly a dog who has had those options removed, like I can't get away and I can't hide, another sort of escape strategy can be aggression, because if a dog bites you, you are probably going to pull your hands back and stop doing what you were doing. But yeah, I see it in mild to moderate form most of the time, occasionally severe, but not too often.
I guess when I think fear, I tend to think of like, yeah, the hiding, the shutdown, the like avoiding, you know. But somebody recently reminded me that it can look, you know, very different in another way. And it was like, oh yeah. And it's all about like reading that body language. And for this kid right here, you know, we learned with the towels, when I went to clean the mud off of her, I mean, you know, I said to my husband afterwards, I said, you know, give her credit. She was communicating, throwing every signal at me that she did not like this, you know, and, you know, and I didn't want it to escalate, you know, because it's about the closest I've felt that like I might get bit,
yeah,
you know, and it was kind of like, you know, but she was doing everything with the eyes, with the ears, with her movement, you know, like kind of doing these very quick movements to like kind of jump away.
Get away. You know?
And,
yeah.
And it was like, I need to step back up, you know. It was kind of like, you know, I was like, I give her all the credit in the world because she did everything right to let me know that this was not good for her, you know.
Yeah, it's it's tough because, like you said, like it feels like a normal thing that you should be able to do, you know, like I should be able to wipe my dog's paws or give him a bath or whatever. But there isn't. I mean, these are living, breathing, sentient beings just like us, and they're individuals, and there's not really any should, you know, you have to ask your dog what they're okay with.
And, you know, I was even sending my husband the link from your website about the nail trims, because that's been something else with her. And we also did figure out that she had some sores between her toes. And I think that that's why she's been so sensitive about her feet. And, you know, so we're trying to address it from that angle also. But so what I really liked in the reminder of, like, it's not just a matter of like, oh, I can get like a licky mat and keep her busy while I'm trimming the nails. Like the way you were breaking it down was like, look, just put the clippers out and give a treat, you know, just make the noise of the clipper, you know, and it's like, oh, I need to get like that basic with it, you know? And I was like, this is what we need to do. Cause we were like jumping 10 steps ahead, you know?
Yeah. Most people do. I mean, that's probably one of my main jobs on a day-to-day basis is just breaking things down more for people. Because yeah, you don't think that you would need to do that. Now for nail trims, I should make a plug for scratch boards for people who can't touch their dog's paws. You can do front and back paws with scratch boards, but getting the back paws is a little bit like more awkward and less efficient. But if you can't touch your dog's back paws, it's better than, you know, not being able to get them at all. So that's always another option. And a lot of dogs really like their scratch boards. Like it's a fun game. It's kind of like a digging game almost. So that's another thing.
Is there any particular one that you like or recommend?
It's probably what I begin every answer with. It depends on the dog. The one that I have used the most in my house is a piece of scrap board that was in our garage. And then I got that grip tape that you put on outdoor stairs, because it comes with, you know, it's self-adhesive. So, and I'm not handy at all. So I could just like stick it on there. And it's pretty wide. You know, I have two large dogs. So I think mine's about 10 to 12 inches wide and a couple feet long. And that has worked well. You can get ones that have treat like drawers or container, like compartments in them. I have a blog post on that where I tried out a couple with my dogs just to kind of see, you know, if you don't do any training, which most people aren't going to do, and just kind of like stick a treat in there and give the dog the thing, is this going to do any good? Maybe. But there are a lot of ways for dogs to try to get treats out. So you don't always get scratching. But for some dogs, those ones with treat compartments could be a helpful training aid, because they can smell the treat in there. And so some dogs might, you know, scratch to get it. There was another one I saw that I haven't tried, but I thought was pretty smart. There's a toy that I actually reviewed this toy for our holiday toy review this year, where part of the puzzle is the dog has to like hit a big button on top to make kibble go out into these little side compartments. And so if you started with that and the dog learned how to use the toy, then there's a version, or you could just make it yourself, but there is a version actually on Amazon with abrasive like sandpaper stuck to that button.
Okay.
So some people get enough out of those without too much training. Things to watch for if you're hoping to get a sort of self-training scratch board is that a lot of dogs are pretty, like they have a preferred paw. And so you might get a dog that their right nails are really well filed and their left nails don't get filed at all. So this is one of many reasons why you might have to do some training. But yeah, I love scratch boards. They're such a nice sort of, there's no confrontation involved like there can be with the, you know, I'm going to clip your nails now. So it's safe, hands off.
Yeah, we've been looking at one. I keep getting an ad for one in my social media feed, and I'm always like, should I just pull the trigger? I feel like I've gotten burned on some of those ads before, so that's what makes me nervous. But
I think if you go into it knowing that you might have to do quite a bit of training, then it's not, you won't be as disappointed. But yeah, if you look at, see something online that seems like, oh, I just give this to my dog and they'll just automatically file their nails by themselves. For most dogs, it doesn't work that way, unfortunately. You have to teach them how to use it.
That's a good reminder. And you had a bunch of interesting handouts on your website that were just all things where I'm like, oh, I could totally see a dog having an issue with that, like stairs was one. What are some, have you ever found some really, any really weird odd ones, or what are some of the ones that you encounter?
Yes. I mean, yes and no. Once you've spent enough time around fearful dogs, nothing really surprises you anymore, but really anything that could be different or change in the environment from what is normal could frighten a fearful dog. So this isn't that weird, but something that a lot of people aren't always sort of aware of and don't recognize it when it's happening is that some dogs are afraid to walk on different surfaces, especially like slipperier surfaces like hardwood maybe or linoleum. And so sometimes a dog won't walk in a certain area, not because they're afraid of that room per se, but because of the surface.
We actually have like a 6-foot runner rug through our kitchen because Nino was so weird about the kitchen floor, because most of our house is carpeted except for in there. And especially as he's gotten a little older, we just went and put the runner down so that he can just get that to get to his food, you know.
Oh, that's smart. Yeah, we have, and that's good for when they get older too. You know, when their back legs start to be a little weaker because they'll slip more. I've had several dogs recently afraid of televisions.
Really?
And it's not always the sound. It's sometimes, even if it's muted, it's the...
like the glare screen. Or something?
You know, maybe. I think sometimes it's the movement on the screen.
Oh, okay.
Sometimes I wonder if it's... like, you know, some older TVs would have a... no, like a humming or a staticky noise when they're on. Maybe that's part of it. I'm trying to think what else is. Usually we're trying to deal with the basics. Like, oh, you know, thresholds are one that might seem weird to a lot of people. The transition between one room and the next. If there is a doorway and it's not even narrow, but not, you know, a big archway. Sometimes there's something about that that worries some dogs. Or even if there's no narrow area, but there's a change in flooring or even some little raised, you know, like a piece of wood that I guess makes the transition between the two rooms smoother. I don't know why those are there, but those kind of like going through doors basically or over thresholds is another one that I've seen a lot of fearful dogs kind of balk at.
And so when you have these kind of really specific fears, is it always just kind of breaking it down and like trying to create some sort of positive association, like whether by treat or toy or whatever is fun for that dog?
Yes and no. I mean, the very first thing is to back up and say, how important is this? So if a dog is afraid of all doorways, that's pretty important because that really restricts their movement. But if there's one particular transition that they don't like, but there's no reason they have to go there, then I can talk with the client about like, well, you know, we can work on this. Probably there are about 12 other things you want to work on. So, you know, can we avoid this for now? Can it all be avoided forever? Because some things it doesn't matter really. If the dog doesn't like to do it, if they don't have to, no big deal. It's kind of like your dog with longer car rides. If you don't need to take him on long car rides, then, you know, car training can be a pretty long process. And, you know, is it worth it? I don't, you know, depends on your goals, I guess. But so first, is it worth it? Then, okay, say yes, dog literally cannot move around the house at all because it's afraid of thresholds. Then you grab your good stuff, dog's favorite things, and sit down with them at whatever distance or whatever version of the scary thing is, like, basically not scary at all. And I like to start by just seeing what they're willing to give me without trying to, like, cue them to do something or, like, use food to lure them closer. You know, will they look at that threshold? Will they take one step? That's your in. Just start wherever the dog gives you something. You say, yes, good job. Maybe toss a treat behind them or a toy so they get to move away from that, you know, threshold of doom. And then they get to come back and they get to do the fun thing again. And you just inching it closer. So they are really tiny steps. For some dogs, it can take a while.
So I recently learned the term flooding. And I was realizing that particularly with, like, the car, like, there are definitely times with Nino where, like, we've probably been guilty of flooding, not knowing that that's what we were doing.
Sure.
Is that a common mistake that you see?
Yeah, and it's sometimes not even done mistakenly, because there are some situations where, for instance, say your dog had to go to the vet right now.
Right.
So sometimes you just have to do it and it's terrible, but the alternative is more terrible. But yes, I think the idea that this happens when people are under the impression that they just need to show the dog that something is safe and then the dog will get over it. Like, people are like, well, my dog's afraid to go outside, so I just picked him up and put him in the yard. Like, you know, that doesn't always fail. Like, yeah, maybe the dog was actually just afraid of, like, that walking over the threshold or down the stairs. And when they're in the grass, there's lots of interesting things and there's reinforcement available. And then maybe in the future they will go out. But more often, at least with the dogs I work with, you do end up flooding them. You know, they were afraid of that and you basically dumped them in the middle of it. And I think, I don't know if this is true. This is just how I think of it. But I think with us, like with humans, flooding can work, but doesn't always. And we have the ability to, like, reason it through, you know,
right.
To be like, okay, I'm not dying, you know, just kind of talk yourself through it. And as far as we know, dogs don't have that kind of verbal behavior where they can talk themselves through the, you know, like, this is fine. So yeah, picking up and putting outside is a common one. Picking up, putting in the car, taking for walks where they have to kind of drag the dog, having a bunch of people over, forced cuddling or petting. You actually see this quite a lot with fearful cats as well. Those are all potential examples where flooding comes in and it's risky.
Yeah, I always feel that way when we do have to, like, take him to the vet or something. It's like, I'm sorry, dude. You know, we go, like, every other month and, you know, we just got to do it. And we try to make it special when he gets home that he gets something special and then he'll, like, get extra, like, an extra walk or we'll do something special when we get back, you know. And I do think, like, over time he's gotten, like, a tiny bit better, but, you know, it's mostly, like, panting, drooling.
Yeah.
He's up, he's down, you know, like, he can't get comfortable kind of thing. And
yeah.
It's like, I'm sorry, dude, we have to do it 6 times a year unless there's an emergency.
Well, the good news about most vet visits is that you, when it's an emergency, obviously you have no, you have no time to prepare, but if it's a routine visit, most veterinarians can talk to you about like pre-visit medication that will help take the edge off a bit. All my dogs get most of the time, depends on what they need to have done, but get something to make vet visits less stressful. So it's something if they have a dog who's afraid of the vet and they haven't done it yet, they could talk to their vet about it and be like, my dog's super stressed out. Is there anything I can give him at home beforehand that would just help make this less traumatic? And a lot of times for a lot of the routine things we have done at the vet, those medications are fine. Like, they don't interfere. And if you are in the midst of training your dog to get better at the vet, those medications can help protect your training because you don't, you know, you're like doing all this careful training and then you're like, but we have to actually go. And now the dog's like, oh, I knew you were trying to trick me. not really, but you know, you're like carefully teaching the dog, like with positive reinforcement to get in the car, get out in the parking lot, walk to the door, walk in the lobby, making it all positive, positive. And then next week we actually go in and you have to get like injections. That's going to totally blow your training out of the water, usually. But if you can basically sedate the dog a little bit, have them a little much less stress, then it can help protect it. Pancake, who's my little guy who's super fearful, he actually has a protocol with our vet set up where immediately upon arriving, sometimes in the parking lot, they toss a blanket over him and give him a quick poke in the rear. And in like a minute, he's out.
Oh, wow.
And then all of his veterinary care takes place with him unconscious. So
oh, wow.
there are some things that makes difficult, but it's a way to get things done without him having a horrible experience.
Right. Yeah. I remember with our old gal Kahlua, we realized like that the waiting room specifically was like very stressful for her. So then it was just like, okay, I'll just hang out with her in the car, you know, and I would just kind of go in, let them know I was there and, you know, can they wave to me when, you know, yeah, it was our turn and try to manage it in that way. And, you know, we've been very fortunate that the vet we work with now primarily works out of her home. And
oh, so nice.
It's not like that stressful experience of, you know, having to go somewhere else. It's just like a house. And I feel like with Nino particularly that's been like a really good thing for him. And I think the first time we even took him to see her, I think it was like summertime and we just kind of did everything out in the yard. And then, yeah, you know, there was a couple times where he could just like walk around and kind of shake it out if he needed to, you know, before we came back. Cause I think he had an ear infection. Like she had to really get in there.
It's no good.
But, you know, I really appreciate like the fear-free veterinary and like things like that, that are trying to take some of the scariness that of how it appears to the dogs, you know, to the animals out of it.
Yeah, it's really nice if they can make those accommodations. I've also had, when it's not winter here, we frequently do all the work like on the lawn outside the clinic. And it is better for sure.
Yeah, that's been a great movement in the veterinary world. And, you know, we had also even gone to a orthopedic vet one time. And, oh my gosh, I wish everybody could take lessons from them. Like, everything was carpeted. And so, because that was always a thing where the dogs would be like slipping on those floors. And they, in the waiting room, they almost had it like little booths.
Oh, nice.
Where you were like kind of, it was like on an angle with like a divider. So you weren't like sitting there staring like at this other dog that's getting all ramped up. You know, you had like your own private little booth.
So nice.
Thought, oh, this is brilliant. You know,
it is. Man.
Granted, as an orthopedic vet and you're paying a lot to
get the money for it. Yeah. They have the money to
at least they're putting the money back in.
Yeah, that's true. That's pretty cool.
So one of the things you mentioned is one of the reasons why I had initially reached out to you was this whole idea of petting consent and learning, does your dog even want to be pet right now? And, you know, I can think of people I've known in my life that are always like, oh, dogs love me. And they're kind of lumbering and looming over the dog. And you're just like, oh, God, what are they doing? Or, you know, people who are always reaching out on top of the dog's head and you can just see them, you know, flinch. And so you have a great video. I'll make sure we link to it in the show notes today. But can you tell us about petting consent?
Sure. Now the term, I should say up front that the term consent has a very particular legal meaning in like human medicine. And as far as we know, dogs can't really give, you know, informed consent in the way that we talk about it with people. So it may not be a very sort of technically correct use of the word. But the idea is to try to give the dog opportunities to give you some information about whether or not they might want to be touched in the first place. And then if you have already started touching or petting them, to then stop and and give them another opportunity to kind of to tell you, to show you what it is they want. And there are no like official rules to this kind of thing. The steps that I have in the video were are very conservative. And the part of the reason for that, well, one is the kind of dogs I work with might be more likely to bite because they're fearful. But also at the time I was working, I was running a behavior internship with a local animal rescue. And I wanted the interns not to be bitten. And that rescue primarily rescued small dogs. And small dogs tend to have more liberties taken with them. You know, people aren't as worried.
Yeah, people just want to pick them up. And
yeah, they're so cute. You know, how bad? If they bite you, it's not that bad. That's not true necessarily, but
right.
that's the impression people have. So the first thing that would be good for people to pay attention to is whether the dog even has chosen to approach you at all, or if you are the one going up to them. In general, and I know people will feel like this is too extreme, and most of the time we get away with all kinds of stuff with dogs, but it's really better not to approach a dog, particularly an unfamiliar dog, although your own dog may not also like to be approached. But if your dog is not choosing to come up to you, or a dog isn't choosing to come up to you, then there's a good chance they don't want to be petted. Otherwise, they would come to you. And then, you know, some dogs, and this is a kind of a gray area that I struggled with how to instruct interns how to proceed. So if the dog has come up to you, you've probably seen online that you don't necessarily want to stick your hand in a dog's face and like let them sniff. You can, you know, make a hand kind of available. Some dogs will move into it if they want to scritch. Or you can move kind of slowly and low and see, does the dog back up? Okay, probably stop. If the dog moves into your hand, that's a good sign. The conservative piece is, what if they don't do anything? What if there's no change in behavior? Sometimes no change in behavior can actually be a freeze, which can be a precursor to a snap or bite. Sometimes it's not, but the safest thing to do is if the dog doesn't show any active sort of solicitation of that petting, just don't do it. A lot of dogs have learned lots of cute ways to get you to pet them if they really want to. You know, they'll paw you, they'll get up in your business. So if the dog's just kind of staring at your hand, I would just slowly retract it and back away. And then the pauses is another thing. And this is probably the most common issue I hear from clients, is that the dog acted like they wanted to be petted, but then after a while, the dog snapped at me. And it's like, well, they maybe did want to be petted at first, but they didn't want to be petted for, you know, 2 minutes. They wanted 10 seconds of petting, or they did want to be petted, but not there. And so taking real frequent breaks where you withdraw your hand and watch your dog's response gives them a chance to use their sort of quieter indoor voice to, you know, to opt out. Either they do nothing, or they move away a little bit, or maybe they get up and walk away. Those are all preferable to the dog snapping or biting. And also if we keep those petting episodes short, that also makes it a little less likely that sort of the level of sort of, I don't know, irritation the dog is feeling has built up to the point they might snap. So really what it is giving the dog lots of opportunities to express themselves and giving us lots of opportunities to stop and just observe, instead of just going in for petting and then kind of mindlessly continuing to touch them.
Well, I'll make sure I put the link. I hope everybody checks it out, because I thought you had some really great examples of different body language in there and of different dogs that were, you know, like you said, like would just not do anything. They weren't leaning towards you, you know, or that they were, you know, actively like kind of moving away. And also, as a pit bull lover, it just made me happy that all the dogs, like almost all the dogs that were like, please pet me right now, were all pit bulls. They're like all over the girl sitting on the ground. And it just made me laugh.
Yeah, those are all shelter dogs.
I think I was wondering. Okay. And I have one right, the one right here at my feet is always letting me know that she is ready for more pets.
Ready for, hello.
She's sticking her head up right now.
Hi.
But that's definitely been something that she has, you know, been very into, been into petting.
Years. Hello.
Like, I would almost say touch starved with her, you know.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things about a lot of pitties is that they're just like, can I just like get in your shirt?
Yeah.
Like, okay. They're so cuddly. Yeah, it is really nice. And it can be hard to find examples.
Well, Kelly, you have just been a wealth of information, and I really appreciate your time today. I'll make sure we have links in the show notes for everyone to check out your website. Like I said, you have all these different like PDFs of like introducing your dog to all different types of like objects and situations. And, you know, some of them I had just never even thought of. And so I want to make sure everybody has access to that. So where can everybody find you?
Our website is dogkindtraining.com. So pretty simple. We're also on Facebook and Instagram and YouTube.
And you also have some different ways that people can work with you online also, is that right?
Yeah, all of our training is online. I have private training, so those are one-on-one sessions that we do via Zoom and then sort of communicate throughout the week in between sessions to reach particular goals. Those are for people that need very, you know, specialized sort of personalized help. We have a training membership called Confidence Builders Club, which is for people who have really fearful dogs and are looking for something that's either a little more DIY or lower cost. And then we have a few online classes, one for reactive dogs, a scent work class, a toothbrushing class. So yeah, we have a lot of ways that you can learn online.
Well, that's wonderful. I'll make sure we have links to everything because I want everybody to go find you. And if they want to work on confidence building, I think you're a great person to help them. So thank you so much.
No, thank you.
Oh my goodness, I'm so grateful to Kelly for everything that she shared with us today. Make sure you check out the links in the show notes to the petting consent test video and also to Dog Kind Training. Her website is just a wealth of information about so many of the different topics that we touched on today. I was thinking about this whole concept of anxiety and fear and confidence in our dogs, and I was thinking of it like on a spectrum, right? From like fearful to confident. And, you know, like my dog Nino was on the fearful end of the spectrum. And for the dogs that I've had in my life, he's like the most fearful. But then listening to some of the experiences Kelly was describing today, it made my whole spectrum kind of widen. And it made me realize, oh, there's dogs that are even way more fearful than Nino. And wow, I'm really fortunate that he was never too scared to go outside and pee. It really made me widen my whole concept on this sliding spectrum scale. And then just thinking about, you know, dogs like I've had, like Lucy, who was like our first dog. I always just am so grateful to Lucy for being such an easy dog. And realizing that there was only maybe one or two situations that ever popped up that really made her uncomfortable. Like one of them had to do with like how light reflected on certain surfaces. I remember bringing her to my office one time and there was like a white tile floor and then you went up these stairs and when you would be trying to come back down the stairs, she would get to a certain point where the sun would be reflecting off that tile and she would just be like, nope. And she would not come down the stairs anymore. And we had this elevator. It was like an older building and the elevator was kind of creepy. And I was like terrified that we'd get stuck in the elevator. And then I had to try to get her in this elevator because she wouldn't walk down the stairs. And anyway, it was just kind of a very funny thing that even our dogs that can be so incredibly confident in so many situations can have these times where like a specific fear pops up. And so I hope if you ever find yourself in that situation again, you'll be armed with so many of these tools from Kelly today to help you navigate through it. So as I mentioned, when I found out about this petting consent test, I really wanted to try it out with my dogs, and I'm going to try to see if I can get some video of it. I'm really not the best at capturing video, let me tell you. So this new girl, Nessie, she is just very thirsty, as the kids would say. She just really can't ever get enough love or pets or attention, except for first thing in the morning, I've noticed. It's the only time that I'll pet her and then stop after a couple seconds, and she's kind of like, okay, I'm good. I really need to go outside and do my business now. And I'm like, oh, okay. But pretty much any other time of the day, it's going to be up to me to stop the petting eventually, because she will just go until my hand falls off. And as for Nino, it was interesting. I think I realized that in some ways, I've been doing a little bit of this petting consent with him over the years, because I realized that it was kind of my natural inclination with him to just kind of give a couple pets and then stop and see how he responds. And what I found is there's a lot of times where he's good. He, you know, maybe I just came up to him and saw he was like snuggled up looking cozy, and I give him a quick pat or a scritch and stop, and then he's like, just lays there and does nothing. And so that's when I'm like, okay, I'm just gonna now take that as my sign to just move on about my day and not try to engage anymore with him, because he was resting. And so I'm grateful for this petting consent to make me more aware when I'm petting the dogs of whether it's something they really want or not. And I think it was also just making me think of just how much our dogs put up with and tolerate us at times with our primate need to reach out and touch things. So if you try the petting consent test with your dogs, you know, post some video online and tag me at Erin the Dog Mom on Instagram, or shoot me a DM and tell me what your results were. I'm so curious. So that'll do it for this episode of the Believe in Dog podcast. If you like this episode, remember that you can always leave a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts. It's pretty much the biggest compliment that you can give a podcaster. You can always find me at Believe in Dog Podcast on Facebook, or at Erin the Dog Mom on Instagram. So until next time, this is Erin Scott sending you hugs and belly rubs. The Believe in Dog podcast is a production of Hugs and Belly Rubs, LLC.